This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio.
Moscow says Washington must remove all sanctions on Tehran and fully honor its commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar introduces legislation to block an arms sale to Saudi Arabia over the kingdom's war on Yemen. Also in the headlines, the latest round of talks between the EU and the UK over post-Brexit trade in Northern Ireland ends without an agreement. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Russian foreign minister says his country will seek the full implementation of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, in the upcoming talks in Vienna. Sergei Lavrov explained that in case the United States returns to the deal, it should honor all its obligations, which include removing all sanctions on Tehran. So far, Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA have held six rounds of talks aimed at removing the sanctions. The next round is scheduled to be held on November 29th in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Tehran says an effective removal of sanctions and the return of all parties to their commitments are the requirements of a good agreement.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar has introduced legislation to block a $650 million arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Omar said it is unacceptable to push ahead with the deal while Saudi Arabia continues to, quote, to slaughter innocent people and starve millions in Yemen. She said the U.S. should not sell weapons to human rights abusers amid the humanitarian crisis they have created in Yemen. The Pentagon announced the deal to sell 280 air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia earlier this month. The contract is the U.S.'s first major military sale to Riyadh under President Joe Biden. Washington is under fire for selling weapons to Riyadh amid its devastating war that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Earlier, I spoke with the Middle East expert Kevin Barrett about the U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia. He says American policies are dictated by corporations and interest groups that profit from the ongoing Saudi war on Yemen.
All of these words coming out of American politicians don't really add up to anything, because at the end of the day, the military-industrial complex war profiteers who are getting rich off the blood of Yemeni children have more influence in Washington, D.C. than the humanitarian groups and even politicians who have this habit of saying good things and then not doing anything. The fact is that typically, you know, once these people actually start jostling for power in Washington and actually making policy, the people who dictate what policy gets made are these big money corrupt interests.
Saudi warplanes have pounded the Yemeni city of Taiz. The attack came hours after another Saudi airstrike killed 4 civilians in Yemen's Hodeidah province. Our Sana'a correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washadi has given us the details.
The Saudi warplanes launched an airstrike against Taiz airport. This airport is being controlled by the Saudi-led coalition, and it has got targeted. It means that maybe the Yemeni army has been advancing there and taking control of the airport. We will know this in a few hours, inshallah. Earlier today, the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes targeted the Tuhaita district in the western province of Hodeidah. This district was controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces in the city. It was controlled yesterday by the Yemeni army after the withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces in the city. It is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement and of the international law. And also it is a crime that 3 children got killed today without doing anything. They were just walking around their homes and they have got targeted by an airstrike from the Saudi coalition.
The Palestine Red Crescent Society says at least 83 Palestinians have been injured during weekly protests against Israel's settlement expansions in the occupied West Bank. The society says the Palestinians were injured in the towns of Beita and Beit Dajan. It says the injuries were mostly caused by tear gas and rubber bullets fired by the regime forces. Many other areas in the West Bank also witnessed confrontations between Israeli forces and anti-settlement protesters. The people of Beita also performed their Friday prayers in front of a new settlement project. In recent months, at least 8 people have been killed and hundreds injured in Beita during anti-Israel demonstrations. Dozens of Palestinians have also been arrested. Mona Kandil says Palestinians are barred from expressing their rejection of Israel's expansionism as the regime uses deadly force against peaceful protesters.
The human rights organizations have been accusing the Israeli soldiers of using deadly force against peaceful and unarmed protesters. This is illegal, where Palestinians here are not allowed to express their opinion, to express their rejection of the seizure of the lands and the ongoing Israeli military practices against them.
Palestinian Islamic Resistance movement Islamic Jihad has held a huge event in the Gaza Strip to mark the second anniversary of the assassination of its top commander Bahar Abul Atta, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike on his home in 2020. Bruba Sharbet has attended the event and filed this report.
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Bahar Abul Atta, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abul Atta triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abul Atta was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abul Atta. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abul Atta in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
A peaceful protest outside a university in the British capital against the Israeli regime's ambassador earlier this week has faced a huge backlash from the British government and media. In spite of no violence or arrests, government officials have condemned the demonstration as anti-Semitic. Pro-Palestine groups have described that reaction as an attack on freedom of speech. Saeed Poreza has sent this report from London.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotobly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotobly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace. As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics. That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
What is the evidence for this? People were opposing the Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who has spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Puriza, London.
The latest round of talks between the EU and the UK over post-Brexit trade in Northern Ireland has broken up without an agreement. However, Brussels says there has been a change in tone from the opposite side.
I acknowledge and welcome the change in tone of discussion with David Frost today, and I hope this will lead to tangible results for the people in Northern Ireland.
Chef Chovic stressed that serious headway was still needed when the talks resume next Friday. The comments suggest that the UK has backed away from its threat of suspending the Northern Ireland Protocol agreed in the Brexit deal. London, however, has denied this, saying scrapping the agreement remains on the table. It has warned that there are still significant gaps between the two sides and the bloc must address issues London has raised. As part of the Brexit withdrawal deal between London and Brussels, checks and controls have been imposed on goods entering Northern Ireland from Britain. The UK, however, wants to change those arrangements. Dutch police have clashed with anti-lockdown protesters outside the Justice and Security Ministry in The Hague. Riot police used water cannons to disperse protesters who threw stones and fireworks in protest against the partial coronavirus lockdown announced by the government. The protest was held while caretaker Prime Minister Mark Rutte was giving a press conference to introduce the measures. The government says restrictions will be reimposed for 3 weeks in an effort to contain a rapid surge in COVID cases. Daily infections in the Netherlands have topped 16,000 for the second day in a row. Turning elsewhere, the Taliban say the United States and NATO failed to bring peace and security to Afghanistan despite their 20-year occupation of the country.
Despite 50 nations, including the Americans and NATO, with their military, their technological power present in Afghanistan for 20 years and with a lot of money that was poured in, they still failed to bring peace and security in Afghanistan or to eliminate the islands of power that existed in the country. Now that we have done all this, we have brought all these changes and given assurances to the world. I do not understand what else the world wants from us.
Amir Khan Muttaqi called for international assistance to help tackle the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. He also expressed concern over Washington's move to freeze Afghanistan's funds after the Taliban takeover in August. Muttaqi said the move has pushed millions of Afghans into a humanitarian crisis, which no one considers to be a violation of human rights. Earlier, a spokesperson for the World Health Organization warned of the potential deaths of 1 million Afghan children from malnutrition. Margaret Harris said the world must not turn its back on Afghanistan. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Spyware made by the Zionist regime's notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of six Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading Zionist regime spyware targeted Palestinian human rights workers. Stay tuned for more. Spyware made by the Zionist regime notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of six Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. Three of the six targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Adamir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, have cooperated closely with the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip by the Zionist regime. The Israeli regime seeks to sabotage that probe and consolidate decades of impunity. The fake regime of Israel accused the targeted groups of serving as arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance group banned by Tel Aviv, Washington, and Brussels. The Zionist regime has not produced evidence supporting its claims. A 74-page secret Israeli regime dossier purportedly proving its case relies on the testimony of two former employees of a seventh Palestinian organization outlawed earlier in the year who are currently in the Israeli regime detention. The Zionist regime likely obtained their testimony under coercion that may amount to torture. Ireland's government, which funds two of the banned groups, dismissed the dossier as containing no credible evidence. International condemnation and skepticism did not, however, prevent the terror designation under the domestic Israeli regime law from being extended by military order to the West Bank, where the organizations are based. The use of NSO Group's Pegasus spyware against Palestinian human rights defenders was revealed by Frontline Defenders, a group based in Ireland. Adam Shapiro, a spokesperson for Frontline Defenders, told the New York Times that the investigation did not definitively prove who used the spyware, but it raises a lot of questions as to the role not only of NSO but also of the Zionist regime. Frontline Defenders stated that the timing of the terror designation's blacklisting Palestinian human rights groups suggests that it is also an effort to legitimate the surveillance of their staff. The Israeli designation of these organizations as terrorists after Pegasus was detected, but just days before this investigation is reported, appears to be a clear effort to cover its actions and disconnect it from any evidence that would discredit these organizations, the Irish group said. Frontline Defenders was contacted by Al-Haq in mid-October about the device of Al-Quds-based staff member and a possible infection with spyware, according to the report published recently. After determining that the device had been infected by NSO Group spyware in July 2020, Frontline Defenders began investigating the devices belonging to the staff of other organizations newly designated as terror groups. They found that five additional devices were hacked with the same spyware. Citizen Lab, based at the University of Toronto, and Amnesty International Security Lab confirmed with high confidence that the phones were hacked with Pegasus, Frontline Defenders said. Pegasus is the name of the spyware made by NSO Group. The hacked devices belong to Qassan Halaika, a field researcher with Al-Haq. Obey Al-Aboudi, director of Bissan Center for Research and Development and a U.S. citizen, and Salah Hamouri, a lawyer with Adamir, who the Israeli regime seeks to deport to France for breach of allegiance to Israeli regime. The three other targeted persons remain anonymous. The U.S. Commerce Department blacklisted NSO Group and Candiro, another Israeli regime company, last week. The sanctions bar the companies from buying parts and components from U.S. companies without a special license. NSO Group in particular has come under increased scrutiny with every new report revealing the extent to which its spyware has been used to target journalists and human rights defenders around the world. The Pegasus spyware can be installed remotely on a targeted person's smartphone without requiring them to take any action, such as clicking on a link or answering a call. Most notoriously, the use of Pegasus was linked to the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi inside Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. Democracy for the Arab World Now recently called on the U.S. to investigate the hacking of the phones of the Palestinian human rights defenders and impose sanctions on those found to be responsible. Four Democratic House lawmakers are also calling for sanctions on NSO Group, arguing that the Commerce Department designation would still allow U.S. investments funds to finance the company. When U.S. investors prop up companies like NSO Group, this implies the asset of the U.S. government, encouraging such companies to continue providing dangerous tools like Pegasus to the most repressive governments, the lawmakers state in a letter to senior administration officials. Meanwhile, a federal judge recently denied a motion by NSO Group to dismiss a lawsuit filed by WhatsApp and its parent company Facebook, now rebranded as Meta, over the targeting of 1,400 of its users with Pegasus spyware over 2 weeks in 2019. NSO Group claimed that it was entitled to foreign sovereign immunity, a protection afforded to government officials even though it is a private company. John Scott Railton, a researcher with Citizen Lab, said that this lawsuit, going forwards, is a massive blow to NSO. The recent revelations of the use of NSO Group's Pegasus software to spy on Palestinian human rights defenders marked a convergence of what had previously been two separate diplomatic issues for the Israeli regime, as noted by the New York Times. NSO Group exports its spyware under licenses from Israeli regime's War Ministry, which issued the order designating six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. The Times noted that, according to the Israeli regime policy, Pegasus cannot be used by a foreign government against Israeli regime phone numbers, such as those belonging to the Palestinians in the outlawed groups. The publication added that an Israeli regime agency, however, would have the authority to use the software against an Israeli number. The new military order outlawing the Palestinian groups in the West Bank puts the organization's staff members and their property at imminent risk of raid, arrest, and reprisals, according to Al-Haq. The military order is wide in scope and may be used to target broad swathes of Palestinian society, including witnesses to and survivors of war crimes. The order states that every member of Al-Haq, whether he is incorporated, associated with it or not, whether he operates on the internet or in another way, and every group, cell, and faction, institution, central branch, or faction thereof, is an illegal organization in the meaning of the defense regulations. Al-Haq said that the military order is based on British mandate-era emergency regulations that were repealed shortly before the end of the mandate and therefore no longer apply. According to Al-Haq, the Zionist regime has repeatedly resurrected the repeated British mandate order dating from 1945 to outlaw any form of peaceful assembly since its military occupation of the West Bank began in 1967. The rights group said that the Israeli regime's culminative campaign of persecution aims at gradually normalizing its inhuman acts of persecution and apartheid towards Palestinian human rights defenders. The Israeli regime is enforcing its threats with total impunity and complete contempt for the strong statements of condemnation from the UN treaty bodies and officials and European states that followed its initial terror designations in October, Al-Haq added. Recently, Al-Haq called on the European Union and third states to remove terrorism clauses as internal conditions placed on donor funding to Palestinian organizations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The rights group also called for comprehensive trade sanctions against the Israeli regime, emphasizing the need to end the sale or supply of military products to the state.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's hardly more than a few years since Mohammed bin Salman rose as the crown prince and the de facto leader of the Saudi kingdom. Yet over this rather short period of time, he has damaged his reputation as a young prince who's seeking to bring the whole kingdom under the yoke of his servitude, while shocking the world with his callous disregard for human life. Arresting other princes, influential people, and rights activists, waging a bloody war on the poor Yemeni civilians, and bringing about a host of other plights such as famine and diseases for them, killing his opponents, exemplified in the case of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, are all just a few instances that show bin Salman is prepared to do any crime to make sure that he will have easy accession to the throne. Yet there are some cases that keep the Saudi prince up at night, like the case of Saad al-Jabri, a former top Saudi intelligence officer now living in exile in Canada. After his interview with 60 Minutes on CBS News, al-Jabri once again hit the headlines. The aim was to pressure bin Salman into releasing his son Omar and daughter Sarah, reportedly detained in an attempt to force him back to the kingdom. I have to speak out. I'm appealing to the American people and to the American administration to help me release those children and to restore their life. In the interview, the former spy master sent threatening signals to Riyadh that he could be a whistleblower if push comes to shove. Al Jabri said bin Salman boasted in 2014 that he could kill King Abdullah using a poisoned ring he had acquired from Russia. In less than a year, King Abdullah died, and his half-brother Salman was crowned king. Al Jabri had already accused bin Salman of an attempt on his life because he knows damaging secrets about how the prince was catapulted to power. Al Jabri says the Saudi crown prince has no empathy and considers him as a person who poses a threat to his people, to the Americans, and to the planet.
Essentially, Mohammed bin Salman came to power under his father as part of a coup. It was a coup that he had initiated. And you'll remember that some of the most important members of the royal family were arrested and detained at the, whatever it was, the Four Seasons Hotel, I think it was. Many of them were stripped of billions of dollars of wealth. They were accused of crimes, including corruption. Some died mysteriously in plane crashes. One was shot down on the border with Yemen. I think these are the secrets. The secrets are that this young man didn't think twice about murdering members of his own family to take power.
In one of his key lawsuits filed in August 2019 against bin Salman, the former intelligence officer said the prince sent the hit team that murdered Khashoggi to Canada to kill him, but were intercepted and deported at Ottawa's international airport.
We have reports that Khashoggi was screaming in agony as they were chopping him up while he was still alive. And why? Because he supported human rights, and he maybe could be seen as an opponent of Mohammed bin Salman. He had never done anything. He had never fomented a coup attempt. He didn't write columns in the Washington Post in opposition to the Crown Prince. He just, you know, could have become an opposition figure at some point in the future, and that was enough for Mohammed bin Salman to order his execution.
Al Jabri's lawsuit reads, "The Tiger Squad defendants attempted to enter Canada covertly, traveling on tourist visas and seeking to avert the detection of Canadian border security by entering through separate kiosks." Observers say the attack on the exiled spy and his family is part of a bigger picture to muzzle the Crown Prince's critics at home and abroad. Al Jabri was long an aide to Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the former head of Saudi intelligence, who later became heir to the throne before being deposed and detained by bin Salman in 2017. Though loyal to his country, Al Jabri has been in self-imposed exile since then, fearing for his life.
You know, the Saudi government has always been run by consensus, a consensus of the family. They have a family council, which is made up of hundreds of senior princes. And the family council is not even consulted anymore, not since Mohammed bin Salman took power. And when he took power, what did he do? He arrested the crown prince. He arrested the Minister of Interior. He arrested the head of the Saudi intelligence service, not because they were corrupt, as he said. I mean, the Saudi family is the definition of corruption. He arrested them because he was afraid that they could eventually depose him. And anybody who he believes could possibly, maybe, someday be a threat is either arrested, exiled, or killed.
On the other hand, the Saudi embassy in Washington has made the statement that Al-Jabri is a discredited former government official with a long history of fabricating and creating distractions to hide the financial crimes he committed. Accusations of this kind are nothing new, as over the past years, many Saudi officials have been arrested on charges of financial corruption. Critics say they are mostly trumped-up charges for political purposes. The most well-known case happened in early November 2017, where about 400 of Saudi Arabia's most powerful people, among them princes, tycoons, and ministers, were detained in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. It proved to be the biggest and deepest purge in the modern kingdom's history.
These embezzlement and corruption charges against Saad al-Jabri and his children are made up. They're concocted. What the Saudis have done is to arrest the man's children in an attempt to force him back to the kingdom. And we all know that the moment that he were to land in Saudi Arabia, he would disappear, and no one would ever see him or hear from him ever again. So he's hoping that Western governments, especially Canada, where he is right now, and the United States, with which he's had a long and close relationship, can pressure the Saudi government to have his children released. They've done nothing wrong. Their only crime is to be his children.
Meanwhile, Hissa al-Muzaini, another daughter of al-Jabri, Saad al-Jabri, says Saudi officials were trying, as part of revenge against her father, to lure her into the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul, where Khashoggi was hacked into pieces. The saga of the Prince and the Sky is a telltale sign of what might be going on inside the kingdom. When an influential and loyal Saudi spy master and his family, who have close ties in Washington and the CIA, are not immune from the Saudi crown prince's whims and wrath, what might happen to Saudi dissidents inside the kingdom?
In the limelight.
The United States has appealed against the British Church's decision to block the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face espionage charges because of concerns over his mental health. We present you an article written by Jill Lawless. The piece is titled U.S. Appeals Decision by U.K. Judge Not to Extradite Assange to U.S. The United States is appealing a ruling by a British judge not to extradite Julian Assange, the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. In January, District Judge Vanessa Braitzer found that U.S. prison conditions would be too oppressive and that Julian Assange would be likely to take his own life. In response, the United States had taken the case to the High Court to contest her findings about Assange and his health. In addition, the United States has offered diplomatic assurances, claiming that it won't put Assange in oppressive prison conditions, which doctors have said would lead to suicide. So what exactly are these diplomatic assurances that the United States has offered, and can they actually be trusted? Why has his health become the focus of discussion despite scores of legal experts, academics, journalists, and historians having all warned that this indictment currently poses the biggest threat to press freedoms. The High Court appeal took place on 27th and 28th of October 2021, lasting just 2 days. The United States is appealing the decision by Judge Breitzer's not to extradite Julian Assange on 5 grounds. These 5 grounds can be summed up in 2 categories. Number 1, Assange's health, and number 2, the diplomatic assurances. As we've mentioned before, Judge Breitzer blocked the extradition of Assange to the United States mainly on health grounds. The U.S. lawyers claimed that she erred in her judgment, that she didn't apply the test correctly, that Assange doesn't meet the criteria for his extradition to be oppressive. They accuse him of essentially being a malingerer, someone who's pretending to be sick. Professor Michael Koppelman is the lead medical expert for the defense. Professor Koppelman's testimony is very important because the judge relied heavily on it to block the extradition. Judge Breitzer said that she preferred his testimony because his notes were more detailed than the other doctors. Professor Koppelman, who also spent the most time with Assange, so because his testimony is so crucial for the defense, the United States lawyers have tried desperately to discredit both the report and Professor Koppelman. In his first psychiatric report, Professor Koppelman did not disclose the relationship between Julian Assange and his wife, Stella Morris, or that they had 2 children in the Ecuadorian embassy. Although this point has nothing to do with medicine or psychiatry, the United States is exploiting it to accuse Koppelman of misleading the court. They say that his medical evidence should be given little or no weight. Julian Assange's lawyer has replied that Professor Koppelman did not conceal anything from the court. He only kept the relationship secret because he was concerned for the privacy and safety of Assange's wife, Morris, and their children. This happened right around the time when we were finding out about Assange being spied on in the Ecuadorian embassy, among other things. In her ruling, Judge Breitzer did say that she found this behavior from Professor Koppelman misleading and inappropriate, but an understandable human response to Morris's predicament. The lead prosecutor for the United States, James Lewis, accuses Julian Assange of being a malingerer, trying to avoid extradition. In the High Court, James Lewis said that if he's clever enough, he can get around extradition. It then becomes a trump card which cannot be dealt with by the requesting state, even if the situation there is 100 times better than in England. The prosecution argues that Assange did not meet the criteria under the Turner test, which tests the inability to resist the impulse to commit suicide. Only that could block extradition. Julian Assange's lawyers respond that Professor Koppelman did find this to be the case. Professor Koppelman says that Julian Assange would not be able to resist the impulse to commit suicide if extradited. He will take his own life. His attorneys also pointed out that there are people who make plans to take their own lives. That's not impulsive, but is still driven by their mental disorder. And so it's unreasonable. It doesn't make sense to say that Assange is not suicidal just because he's not impulsively suicidal. The appeal hearing in the High Court consisted of various accusations from the prosecution that the defense's medical experts were lacking in expertise or integrity. For example, that Professor Koppelman had misled the court, that the medical expert for the defense was wrong in his autism diagnosis, and so on and so forth. The other main topic discussed in the High Court was that of diplomatic assurances. The United States has said that if Julian Assange is extradited, it will not place him in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are some of the worst prison conditions imaginable. The United States also claims that Assange won't be sent to ADX Florence, one of the worst prisons in the country. Robert Hood, the former warden at ADX Florence, described it as worse than death. The U.S. also claims that Assange could serve a potential sentence in his home country of Australia. At the High Court hearing, James Lewis actually argued that Assange can't be that suicidal because he can look forward to going to jail in Australia. As if going to jail in one's home country is something that every journalist dreams of. The prosecution claims that they weren't given a fair chance to offer these assurances before, and had they done so, the judge would have ruled differently. Lawyers for Julian Assange point out that this isn't true. They say the United States had many opportunities to offer assurances that Julian Assange won't be placed under SAMs or special administrative measures. Instead, the prosecution not only said that special administrative measures are possible, but that they're okay. They said that Julian Assange can do crochet and write poetry and self-recreate, which essentially means going into an adjacent empty room to spend time by himself. Maureen Bird used to be the warden of a notorious jail in New York, the Metropolitan Correctional Center. She testified at the hearing and described what prison conditions are like in pre-trial special administrative measures. She said that inmates were in solitary confinement technically for 24 hours a day. There was absolutely no communication by any means with other inmates, and the only form of human interaction they had was when the guards came to inspect their cells or give them food through the slot in the door. The Center for Constitutional Rights says special administrative measures are the darkest corner of the U.S. federal prison system, combining the brutality and isolation of maximum security units with additional restrictions that deny individuals almost any connection to the human world. They prohibit prisoners who live under them from contact or communication with all but a handful of approved individuals, and impose a second gag on even those few individuals. The net effect is to shield this form of torture in our prisons from any real public scrutiny. Last year, at the Old Bailey, anonymous testimony was heard from former employees of UC Global, the Spanish firm in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian Assange had been given political asylum. The employees described how the United States got them to spy on Assange by installing cameras and secret microphones. And there were even discussions about physically hurting or kidnapping the WikiLeaks founder. And recently, for the first time, we saw the Yahoo News story brought up in court. Published in September, it has 30 U.S. officials admitting that the CIA was discussing plans to potentially assassinate Julian Assange or kidnap him in London. This corroborated what had already been revealed by UC Global employees. Julian Assange's lawyers pointed out that even former CIA director Mike Pompeo confirmed this to be true. So if the decision to place Julian Assange under special administrative measures is up to the Attorney General with input from the CIA, of course they're going to put him in special administrative measures. This is the same agency that was discussing maybe killing Assange. It's the same agency whose files he published in the 2017 leaks. There is no doubt that they will put him in special administrative measures. His lawyer explained that even if Assange isn't placed in special administrative measures, which he almost certainly will be, despite reassurance to the contrary, he can still be put in other oppressive conditions. Mark Summers, Julian Assange's lawyer, said you can be entirely confident that in the event of surrender to the United States of America, Julian Assange will enter into administrative segregation. He added that administrative segregation is isolation. There is no assurance from the United States not to place Assange under administrative segregation.
This is IRIB English Radio.